All right, everybody, welcome back. My name's Simon Ward, and I'm your host for this High Performance Human podcast, a weekly show where it's my goal to share information which will educate and enable you to achieve your potential, both as a human and an athlete, and also help you to create the foundation to be the best version of yourself. And right now, during the COVID-19 pandemic, we are all trying to navigate our way through some extremely challenging times. And for the next few weeks at least, I want to share some insight into how others are adapting to the situation and try to provide you with some ideas and resources that might be of help. Personally, I feel this is a time when we as coaches can step up, help the community with leadership and guidance, and also provide a little bit of optimism. And right now, I realise that many of you see what we're doing in the SWOT community in terms of supporting our athletes, and you might want to be part of that too. And after all, it's great to be part of a virtual community at the moment, particularly when we're restricted in our movements and perhaps even confined to our own homes. And if you do want to join us, please scroll down through the show notes, click on the link at the bottom, and we'll be only too happy to have you join the group. At the same time, I'm also aware that many people are struggling financially. And whilst we'd love to have you as part of our community, we don't want you to feel excluded if you're uncertain about finances or the future. We don't want you to feel like this is something that you can't join. So, if you're interested in joining our group, because as I've said, and I'd like to reinforce it, being part of a virtual community now can be a great help, then please just reach out to us via email. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your situation and why you want to join, and we'll try and find a way in which we can help you out wherever we can. Okay, enough preamble. Let's get rolling and crack on with today's guests. Hey folks, welcome back to another edition of the High Performance Human podcast. And today I am joined by a man. I've been trying to get this guy on the show for about 6 months now. We had some technical difficulties originally, but the coronavirus has played into our hands now because he's stuck in his farm in the middle of the woods. He can't go anywhere, so he has no choice but to chat to me. So I'd like to introduce my guest for today, Gary Cantrell, who is known to the most people by the name of Lazarus Lake. So firstly, sir, welcome to the show.
Oh, glad to be here. The technical difficulties, of course, it was my capability to connect anything more complicated than a phone call. So my technical expert, Sandra, here has linked us up, or else we'd be restricted to a phone call.
Well, what's happened in the meantime is that the system we were using originally when we booked the call, Laz, was called Ringer, but we've moved to Zoom now, which also gives us the benefit of being able to see each other.
Yeah, it's like magic.
It is. So I've also joined on the show today by my assistant, Beth Smith. Beth was insanely jealous that I was getting to chat with you today, and so I invited her to join. So she may be asking some questions. So as we've already ascertained, she's in California, I'm in the UK, and you're sort of in the middle of us in Tennessee, in the woods.
Yes, indeed. I am trapped and surrounded with little or no escape, but we're more than 6 feet apart, so...
Well, just before we started then, we were talking about your situation where you live. You're in the middle of the woods. You said your nearest neighbor's, 2 miles away, did you say?
That's about a half mile. Okay. But it's closer to walk to Ben's house through the woods than it is to go on the roads.
Yeah, so coronavirus hasn't really changed your lifestyle a great deal, I suppose.
No, every 2 weeks I go to the dump, and... used to be I would run whatever other errands I have, but now I've reduced the number of errands so that I don't have to go anywhere.
Yeah, it is different though, isn't it? Socially distancing because you've been told to rather than because you choose to.
It's really strange. It's just seems somehow different when you can't leave than when you choose to not leave.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, Laz, you know, I'm a triathlon coach, and as I say to all of my guests on this, I don't like to start any session that I do with my guests or my athletes without having a warm-up first. So we sent you a few little questions. They shouldn't take a great deal of time to answer, but it'll just get you into the swing of the chat today. So I took a guess that you might like a little tipple, but I wasn't sure whether your favorite drink would be bourbon or beer.
Oh, moonshine. If you drink alcohol, it should taste like alcohol.
Absolutely.
Les, you make your own then? Do you make your own moonshine there?
No, I don't. I come by it the normal way. I don't drink a whole lot, which is fortunate because I think that my guy is on a paid vacation at government expense right now.
Well, I mean, one thing about the coronavirus is that they were encouraging everybody to use hand sanitizer to kill the germs, and it has to be at least 60% alcohol. So I guess you could use the moonshine for dual purposes there.
Yes, when you drink moonshine, you just pass the jar around, and people from outside will say, well, how do you clean the jar between people? It's self-cleaning. You're not going to get anything from sharing moonshine.
So when the president was instructing everybody to sort of start thinking about injecting disinfectant, maybe he should have just suggested just everybody drink moonshine.
You know, I don't want to be the one to experiment and see if that works.
I mean, no. Well, maybe Mr. Trump should try his own medicine, perhaps, before he suggests everybody else tries it. But we don't want to get it political. It's easy for me to say things like that from the UK. You two have to live there. So let's get on to the next question then, Laz. So given the choice, would it be pizza, hot dogs, or burgers, or are you a vegetarian?
No, I saw that question, and it would be tough, really wicked burgers out here with chopped up habanero peppers on them and blue cheese. And also, when frying the hamburgers, we cut out big chunks of cheddar cheese and drop it into the grease so that it fries. There is nothing better than fried cheese with hamburger grease in it.
Oh, sounds like we need to make a trip to Tennessee. Okay, so this is a good one for all Americans. Is it Pepsi or Coke?
Dr. Pepper.
Dr. Pepper. Yeah, actually, I do remember reading the Outside Online article. I should have known that one. So neither of those. What about in Tennessee? The Titans are based in Tennessee, aren't they? So are you a football fan or are you a hockey fan? Or something else?
Yes, I'm a big football fan. I do enjoy my football, particularly college football, which is kind of a thing here.
Yeah, what's your main college team that you support then?
It would be Oklahoma. When I was a kid, I lived on the Oklahoma, right off the Oklahoma campus, and there were the married football players lived in the same housing all around us, and I spent a lot of time with the players off the team, and they would take me places and do things with their family, and I just felt like I had a connection with the team ever since.
So what nickname do the Oklahoma team go by?
The Sooners.
The Sooners. Oh, okay, right.
They opened up Oklahoma in a land, and so it was open territory, and at a certain time on a certain day, they fired a gun, and all the people were supposed to rush in and stake out their claims. And some of the people had snuck across and hammered in their stakes prior to the actual opening, and they were called the Sooners.
Okay, right. Excellent.
I'll let you figure out why.
Yeah. So aside from Dr. Pepper, then, do you drink tea or coffee?
I like tea, sweet tea.
Ah,
it's
a
Southern thing also.
Well, we have a very nice brand of tea here in Yorkshire called Yorkshire Tea. Maybe I'll put some in a box for you and a package and send some out to the woods for you.
My friend growing up, Caleb, was from England, and his mother always told us that iced tea was an abomination.
Yeah, it's too cold in England for iced tea.
Yeah, it's not iced tea country.
No. What do you like? You like animals, Lass? Are you a dog or a cat person?
I've got a couple of dogs that are here at the house, and they consider themselves to be my business partners. If I do something, they want help. The trip, the biweekly trip to the dump is a huge event for me and the dogs.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not lucky enough to live in the country like that, but since we've had this sort of lockdown that's been imposed on us, the weekly trip to the superstore has been my highlight of the week. I would never have said that before.
Do you do like the dogs and you run in circles and jump up and down?
No, I'm not going to admit that publicly, but yeah, between you and I and Beth, yeah. What about music then, Laz? Are you a country fan, or do you like rock, or is there something else that you prefer to sort of get you going?
I listen to all kinds of music. I like the rock and what used to be new wave. I guess it's old wave now, industrial.
Yeah.
Like a lot of classical music. And then the old time country, the banjo and the fiddle and.
Oh, well, I'm a new wave fan. I was sort of brought up in that punk rock area with the Sex Pistols and the Clash and everything. I was just getting into my teenage years when they were at their height. So that was a fun time to be a teenager in the UK. What about traveling, Laz? Have you traveled a lot, and do you have a favorite place where you like to go for a holiday, or are you quite happy in the woods there?
It's a combination, really. Before the lockdown, I was getting to travel a lot, to go to races in different places, and I've been going to races in different places for a long time. I like to go somewhere new, and then I did a Transcon a couple of years ago, and I'm planning hopefully for next summer to do another one. And you get to really see a place when you go through it at 2 miles an hour.
Yeah, Transcon. That's transcontinental. So that's walking from one side of the U.S. to the other. Yeah.
Yes, I went from Newport, Rhode Island to Newport, Oregon, which was a little over 3,300 miles. So that way, I have a 5,000-kilometer best. Most people say if you don't have a 5,000 K time, you're not a real runner. You're just kind of provisional.
5,000 K, not 5,000 meters.
That's what most people say. I hear that all the time.
Beth, you had your hand up.
So, Laz, when you do that Transcon, do you do homestays as you go, or you have a motorhome?
The last time I did homestays, and if I didn't stay in homes, I stayed in motels. And when I was younger, I would sleep in cemeteries and behind churches and here and there. But somewhere after 60, sleeping on the ground being fun is too hard to get up.
Yeah, I guess it would have been dead quiet in the cemetery.
Yeah, people say, you sleep in a cemetery? I said, yeah, if someone comes in there at 3 a.m. and this stinking, stiff, sore runner gets up going, oh, there's not going to be trouble.
I have some friends who are international trail runners. You know, they do a lot of the mountain races in Europe, and they have a fondness for camping rough like that. And they were in the pub one night in this village, and they couldn't find anywhere to sleep. So one of them said, well, why don't we just walk to the top of the hill? I mean, call it a mountain. It's about 1500 feet, but so they sleep on the top of the, of this mountain near the cairn, right at the top. And it got quite cold overnight. So they were all huddled up and absolutely comatose in their sleeping bags. And at about sunrise, this gentleman comes walking up with his dog, and the dog runs over and sniffs him, and nobody moves because they've been drinking as well the night before. So they're all still fast asleep. And if you're that dog walker and you see three prone physical forms lying there in front of you, not moving at all, even when the dog's sniffing you, you start to think the worst. And so this guy walked over tentatively thinking they were all dead bodies. And then they did exactly what you did. They sort of stretched out and groaned and moaned. And I think it gave him the scare of his life.
We had a Vol State runner one year take a nap in these people's garden, and he was laying there asleep and the feet was morning started and this little kid comes out and he hears him hollering, "Daddy, Daddy, there's a dead man in the garden."
Yeah, you wouldn't want to go outside and look, would you, just in case? Okay, Laz. Well, let's get on with the main part then, because I've got so many questions for you, and you've done so much in your life. I'm hoping we can get all done before you need to head off on your walk for the day. So, let's talk about your running career. How did you get started with running? Did you run when you were at college?
Back in the 60s, they had a news report about a family that did this thing called jogging. And I guess that really triggered the first running craze in the U.S. And my dad and all his friends would go down to the track and they would run a mile. And his goal was to run a mile in under 8 minutes. And I went with him. And first time I ever beat my dad at anything. We're kind of a competitive family. And this is not a family where you let the kids win. When you win, it's because you won. And so I felt like I was a runner. Then when I started high school, and I was I don't know how to translate this really, 5 feet tall, 70-pound sophomore in high school, and came from a sports-oriented family and felt like you played some sport. There was no other sport available except running, because I was too small for everything. Even in wrestling, I would be 10 kilos lighter than the lightest weight division. It doesn't leave many options. It's really the story of my life. I didn't get what I wanted, but what I did get was better for me. If I'd been the football player I wanted to be, my career would have been over for about 5 decades.
I guess there's a lot of runners that became runners because they weren't big enough to play football or rugby in this country, and there's also a lot of rugby players who became rugby players because they were too big to run fast.
That's probably truth to that. You have to put some attention to what your body allows.
So, at what point in your running career then did you start to get enticed by the longer distances?
That was from the beginning when I ran track and cross country in high school. I'd run the longest distances there were because I was not fast. And I looked at it and thought, you know, I do the very best with the longer distances because that I'm durable and I can take a lot of punishment and I work hard. So I would move to the longer distance, to the road races and up to the marathon and eventually to ultras. The problem is that everyone else who moved up to those distances did it because they had the exact same characteristics. So I never really seemed to get anywhere.
So do you just have to keep increasing the distance then until nobody comes with you?
I think I passed the top of my competitive days, and mediocre is the best I was ever going to be.
At what point did you, from starting young, competing with your dad, at what point was it not about family competition and you actually started enjoying it?
There's always been a bit of competition in it. Whether it's nature or nurture, I couldn't say, but I have kind of a competitive bent. I enjoy the running itself. I like my daily workouts. I like to get out and go. It's just walking now because time and excessive mileage have not been kind. But get together in a race, I still want to beat anyone I can beat. And I like that.
Yeah, I think we all like a bit of competition every now and again, don't we? It keeps us all younger than we think we are. Or it keeps us all thinking we're younger than we are, one of those.
Or reminds you how old you are.
Yeah. Well, I think if you live in the you know, if you live in the running environment, then you compare yourself against runners. But if you step out of that environment and compare yourself with the rest of society, I should think you're probably near the front of the queue, Laz, for people in that sort of like 10-year age bracket. It's just because you're comparing yourself against runners that you feel perhaps you're not doing quite as well.
No, I see people sometimes. I see people out, and I think, boy, they look old, or people that I went to school with, and it's been a few years now. We had a reunion, and you look around and think, you know, I beat myself up a lot running, but I'm still better off than the people that have been watching TV for 50 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you still, I suppose if people went and Googled it, Laz, they could find out how old you are, but you still got the enthusiasm to do all of these, put all of these events on and come up with new ones. And you've still got the enthusiasm and energy to think about walking, you know, from one side of the US to the other. I don't know many people in the right mind of any age who would think about doing that. So
it was a weird thing on talking. People ask you about the Transcon. The number one question they ask is, why did you want to do it? And it's not even a logical question. You look on the map and there it is. There's an ocean here and an ocean there, and they're 3,000 miles apart. And I would think the first thing anyone would think is, I need to do that.
Well, I suppose that if you get up and go walking around your, you know, the where you live, and you go walking every day and you do 5 or 6 miles, eventually you cover 3,000 miles, don't you? So, but you just come back to the same, bed every day. There's no difference in doing that apart from where you sleep in going from one side of the US to the other.
This year, I'm probably on track to get maybe between 2,500 miles or so. So it's less than 3,000 in a year, as opposed to doing 3,000 in 4 months. So it's a little different.
I saw that, read in a magazine, Laz, that you used to keep meticulous records of all your mileage. Do you still do that then?
When I retired from thinking of myself as competitive, I quit keeping long-term records. But when I'm preparing to do something, I track all of my mileage in preparation, because I have to make a plan for my training.
Yeah.
You know, the Transcon, when I start planning to start next May, but I started training for it in January. And I have specific things that I want to do to get my old body ready for that kind of treatment.
So we talk a lot with Simon's athletes about, and Simon talks a lot about gadgets and whether they're, you know, more of a benefit or more of a burden. Are you using maps when you're planning your journeys and tracking your miles? Or are you using a watch or GPS?
I use maps, but I do look at the maps on the computer. They're more easily available than they are to order them made out of paper. But yeah, I plan it all on maps. My only watch is an $11 Walmart wristwatch that tells me the time.
Yeah, you could teach us all a lesson by that. Then that's good.
and the miles, because there's been a lot of discussion of that. The miles that you add up, they're whole miles. And so I measure the courses out. I have around the house, probably like most everybody else, measured from my mailbox, there's a half mile and a mile and a mile and a half and 2 miles. And that way, I've measured all my various courses, and if I'm doing a course and my training calls for a little extra, I can walk. If I need 3 extra miles, I walk from the half mile to the 2 mile mark and back. And just as I'm going out, I do that stretch and then continue my normal walk. But I think everybody does that, right?
I can remember before we had GPS watches and things, I used to get, you know, when I wanted to know how far I'd run, I'd get the Ordnance Survey map, and I would get a piece of paper and I would draw a little mark on it from one point to the next, and then I would turn the corner and I would draw another mark on the paper, another mark, until I'd gone all the way along the paper, and then I'd measure how many inches that I'd ticked off, and then I would measure that against the scale for the map and work out that I'd done 5.4 miles, and that would become my, that was before I was old enough to drive and I didn't have a computer on my bike. So that was how I worked out how far I'd run, a very old and rudimentary way, but sort of seems to give you a lot more satisfaction than just being able to press a watch.
Actually, figuring out trail mileages, have used a piece of string, and you tack the piece of string down and then you lay it all along the course till you get to a distance, and then tack it and run it around so that your inch of string, you figure out how many inches it is and compare it to the
sounds
the thing. But all my training has to be measured in whole miles. The tenths and the hundredths drive me crazy. So when I have a course measured out, if it's 7.3, I truncate it to 7. You can't count mileage you didn't do, so you always truncate it. And by coincidence, it turns out that I pretty much never had a course that was more than 3/10 of a mile over a mile, because if it's further than that, you want to figure out a way to make it to get it to the next whole mile.
So if you'd been organizing the original marathon, Laz, there wouldn't have been the 0.2 at the end of 26 miles, would there? There'd have just been 26 miles.
It would have just been 26 miles. Probably would have been the 0.2, but you just truncated to your last whole mile.
So all of those people that say, I've run 26.2 now, we're just calling it 26.
I know we're going to talk about Barkley with you in a bit, but do you then still use the same method to measure Barkley every year with the different courses?
Yeah, you use the string method to measure the Barkley.
Wow.
And people like to pretend that it's way longer than it is, but that's just to try to excuse the kind of times that they record.
Well, that's a nice segue for the Barkley Marathons, Laz. So let's talk about the story behind that event. I mean, people could, and we could put a link to the various articles that have been written about the Barkley Marathons and James Earl Ray and all of that sort of Prison Break. But tell us the sort of like the condensed story behind that whole race and how you came to get going with it.
Well, before it stopped being fun sleeping on the ground, we did lots of backpacking. And one of the places that we would go backpacking trips was Frozen Head. Excuse me. But we went with lots of normal people. And when you got the topo map out and were planning your trip, we could see these trails over there where the contour lines were so close together, it looked like the map was shaded. And Rob, Carl, and I, we looked at those and said, oh, we've got to do that someday when the people who know better are not with us. So we planned a trip and went out there by ourselves to hike the entire boundary loop, the first Barkley loop. And we backpacked that thing, and it was just as difficult as we'd imagined it would be. And nobody'd been out there since the 1930s. So it was overgrown and blowdowns everywhere. It took us from like 8 o'clock one morning until about 10 o'clock the next morning to just make one loop. And all the way around, we were saying, what a great race this would make. This would be a ball buster. So the Rangers, you had to get special permission to go on that trail, and because no one had actually completed a loop since they made it a park. And after they tried to talk us out of it and let us go anyway, we showed up the next morning and said, we did it, and we have friends who would really enjoy this. We want to have a race.
How long did it take before they gave you permission then for that?
We didn't have any problem getting permission from the guy who was the ranger right then. And I think to a great extent because they just couldn't imagine it was possible people would run that.
So where does James Earl Ray fit into all of this, Laz? Because when people write about the Barclay Marathons, he's always part of the story.
That's kind of where the 100-mile part came from, because that I had been backpacking up there for some time. He escaped in 76, and I think the first backpacking trip we took up there was 73. And we watched the whole thing with him being chased down. It was, I think, people all over the world watched it, but especially in Tennessee. And I knew where he was running from the dogs. I said, you know, hell, they wouldn't catch me with those damn dogs. I wouldn't be 8 miles away in 2 days. I could be all the way to Kentucky. I could do 100 miles in that time. But I was young and cocky, so.
It was probably true.
I learned a lot about the dog chases because a lot of the parts of the Barclay course, the people that after they closed down the prison and we had to go through the old prison property, the guys that had the dogs that they used to run people down, including the one that was actually handling the dogs when they got James Earl Ray, they showed us the secret routes to go out there and to get up to different mountains and get to different places. And I learned about how the dog chases work, and it was a disappointment because I think all of us, when you watch a TV show or a movie and they're chasing down someone with dogs, you think, I could get away. They couldn't catch me with those dogs on leashes. But what it is, they know the area and they have multiple dog teams. So once they run you in a certain direction and they can figure out from the lay of the land where you have to go, they put another dog team in front of you and turn you back.
Nah.
And so there's no telling how far he went in his 86 hours because that they were running him in circles with the dogs. It takes kind of some of the fun out of it, but I'd still like to be young again and have them put me out there and try to catch me with dogs. Wouldn't you?
I think that's your 2020. That's your 2021 event then.
You know, I'm afraid the dogs would catch me. They give me a 5-minute head start. I'd still be in sight.
Well, Laz, you talked about how you and your friend were thinking that race was going to be a complete ball buster. I've read in more than one place that you are called a sadist creature. Do you take that as a compliment then?
it's really, you know, because I think technically a sadist is someone that derives sexual pleasure from inflicting pain. And the pain is really just kind of coincidental, discomfort. We like to do fun things, and sometimes to have fun, you have to be willing to put up with a little discomfort.
Yeah, I think secretly humans like to have that discomfort. I mean, you know, in the triathlon world, people keep coming up with just more and more outrageous races that you'd think nobody would ever want to do that. And of course, as soon as they announce that they've got this event, the inbox is full and they've got all of their people. They're never short of volunteers to do these sorts of things.
It's the Barclay. It's a 1% finish rate, and that everybody wants to know if they're in the one. And it's 1% of a select field, so you want to know: are you in the 1% of the 1%? Are you in the 99.9th percentile?
Do you ever consider making it making a little bit less difficult to increase that? Are you happy with the 1%?
It's a real trick to try to put it at that 1% mark. It's easy to make a course that lots of people can finish, and it's easy to make a course no one can finish, but it requires a lot of thought and practice and years of experience to be able to try to peg one that's right around the 1%.
Well, you just
for the challenge of doing it, it's right. Fun.
Yeah.
Just talking of the 1% then, Laz, how many times has the event actually been completed in full up to the last race you did? And because I know that there are some people who've completed it more than once. So how many times has it actually been completed in full, and how many people are responsible for those finishes?
There's been 18 completions by 15 individuals. One guy did it twice, and Jared Campbell, of course, the legend, has done it 3 times out of 5.
Wow. And how different a course is it every year? I mean, does it go around the same rough route? Just in
it stays pretty much the same from year to year, and you just make a few small adjustments so that there's always new stuff. Nobody can get there and they already know the course. There's always a little bit of thought, and eventually over a period of years, these little small tweaks add up until the course becomes very cumbersome, and at that point we make a major change, and there's just like this big overhaul of where it goes. And the first year after a major change is always really tough because nobody knows vast swaths of the course.
Do you make it known that there's been a big change, or is that a surprise?
They'll figure it out.
Yeah.
We tell them that, but we tell them lots of things. And there's always a certain amount of uncertainty as to whether what we're telling them is exactly true or not. And what are the implications?
So, Laz, it's called the Barclay Marathons, but what is the exact, I know it changes each year, but what's the rough distance for each loop if it was done correctly, i.e. the shortest way?
20.00 miles. We measure it with great precision.
And then there's 5 laps of the 20 miles.
And there's 5 laps, which comes to 100 miles.
Okay, cool. So why do you have such a limited number of runners then? I mean, you clearly could sell it out many times over. So what was it that caused you to restrict it to? I don't know. What do you restrict it to?
40 people.
40. Okay.
We go through basically a wilderness area. It's a natural area. We've really been fortunate to have people in that are involved in protecting this resource. When I was a kid, you could go all over Tennessee. There was wilderness areas all over the place. And all the places that I used to go when I was a kid, they're either a park or they're gone. Frozen Head was one of them. It didn't used to be a park. It was just a state forest. And so they set it up to preserve the area. We looked at it as we went along. We started with 25 and then inched it up because we'd go back out there after it was over to see what impact that we'd have. We wanted to be a number of runners where expert woodsmen can tell we were there. But as far as you know, making visible trails and marring the area, we stopped short of doing that. And it's not just the 40 runners, but we select the fields according to ability. There's only a certain number of elite athletes who have the ability to do 5 loops. And then you run down further in the field. You have a lot of people where that if they make 1 loop, it'll be really good, or 2 or maybe 3. Because the number of loops is what determines our impact. And the staging area at the campgrounds, we can handle 40 runners. So we set it up that the maximum number of people possible get to experience being out in a wilderness area without trashing it for the next people. Does that all make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So you definitely an eye on.
We just recklessly pull the number out of our ass and we just go out there and do whatever the hell we do.
Now, you know, it seems to me, Laz, that actually getting an entry form to enter is as tough as completing this race. So can you give me any insider tips on how you go about getting an entry, at least the ones that you're willing to reveal?
It's really simple. You just send in your essay by the approved route on the day that the entry opens, and I recommend that you send it within a second of that time. Unless there's too many essays for me to read, that cuts off further entries.
So how do people find out what the approved route is and what's the day?
I don't know. They're devilishly clever, aren't they? Because thousands of people have figured it out.
Okay, cool.
How many entries do you normally get? How many essays?
We really reduced the number of essays quite a bit. We added this race, the Barkley Fall Classic, and it has some of the signature hills, but it's more of a normal trail run with aid stations and a mark course and all those kind of weak things that you have, and people run it and they come in. We try to keep it around the 30% finish rate. And they come in and say, well, it's a 50-kilometer loop. They say, was one of these loops equivalent of a Barkley loop? And we tell them, no, it's not even close. And they say, I won't be sending an essay. I say, don't worry, do something worse than this.
Okay.
But it still is probably 1,500 or 2,000 people send stuff in. I can't read, but like the first 300 or 400.
When people show up to the, you know, when you've selected the people then, Laz, and they all, and the 40 runners show up, can you tell straight away which ones are going to fail and not even get one lap, and and which ones are going to get maybe one or two?
You get a pretty good read on that just when they send in their essays. People who are going to be a prospect to finish, you can see it in their eyes when they get there, because they've got that 1,000-mile stare. They're there and interacting, but they're not there, if you know what I mean.
I do. Yeah, you see that in triathletes as well, and you can tell the ones who are going to do okay. They're usually the quiet ones as well.
Yes, they're preoccupied. They're focused. Everything is about accomplishing the task at hand.
I'm quite interested, Laz. A lot of the stuff that the Barkley Marathon seems to be about is similar to what you might expect Special Forces soldiers to be doing in their sort of buds or whatever they do in the SAS. You know, do you ever get any Special Forces soldiers, and how do they fare?
We get a lot of people with Special Forces type experience from not just the U.S. but all over the world, and they, by and large, do pretty good. They're not certainly the ones that are going to go 8 miles and quit. But as far as, they haven't filled up the ranks of finishers, although there has been Special Forces people to finish. They've got that mindset that really helps them get there.
Yeah.
The biggest common thread between the finishers is a PhD.
Yeah, I've seen that. Why do you think that is then? Is that because it takes that sort of that smartness to figure it out as well?
It's a problem-solving mentality. They are people who set long-term goals. They're people that do something where they can fail. And the, what is it they call it, the dissertation? It all ends with a thing where people aren't trying to pass you, they're trying to fail you. I think it's just a frame of mind. Same reason that the Special Forces people do well, and also is it's a frame of mind.
So apart from having to complete 20 miles, do they get 24 hours to finish it? Each lap?
The loops or the?
The loop, yeah, the loops.
It's you get, when we added the fun run for three loops as a fun run finish, you get a 40-hour limit. To do the 160 hours takes 12 hours a loop, but the 40 hours only 1320. So you're not an official finisher for if you go over 13 hours and 20 minutes. But we won't probably come look for you for at least a couple of days.
And then you just send the dogs out.
Just so you know.
So describe some of those hills that look like shading areas on the map, but describe some of the things that make this such a tough task then for people to even get around one lap in some cases.
Uncertainty is the most difficult thing an athlete ever deals with, and the Barkley is built around uncertainty. I figured that out as an athlete, learned it as a coach. We instilled it when I used to coach the sports for youth sports and at the high school, and you build uncertainty into their training to teach them to deal with it. Because I guess since you're an athlete, if you think about it, uncertainty is the hardest thing to deal with. And that's why people plan meticulously to try to eliminate the uncertainties. Well, you can't do that here. You don't know when it's going to start. You don't know exactly what the course is until right before the race. You don't know when it'll start until an hour in advance. It's not marked. You're never totally certain that you're in the right place except when you get a book. And when you put that book bag back and walk on, then you don't know again until you get to the next one. And so it's all, that's what really makes it difficult. It's what wears people down. The time limit is set. If you look at it from the outside and you think, well, with the 12-hour time limit, you're going to build up a cushion on the first lap. People usually between 8 and 9 hours is the sweet spot. You've not gone so fast that you're just going to crash and burn and be found your smoldering wreckage beside the trail by other runners later. But you're not so slow that you run out of time. During the night loop, though, you're going to lose that cushion. And then the next day, you've got to make enough cushion back to survive the next night with enough time to finish. And in reality, the people that have a chance to do it, they've done the calculations, their experience, they understand from the very beginning, you have no extra time. The time limit is right on your ass every minute. So every tiny mistake, you feel like, I don't have time. I don't have time. I can't afford this 30 minutes. I can't afford this 10 minutes. And you have to, which is another uncertainty. Am I going to run out of time? Am I going to run out of time? Do I have the time? You have to be able to just go through all that on a perfectly even keel.
I would imagine that because anybody that's doing ultra running, no doubt could train, can do the physical training for your race. But I would imagine that it's that mental uncertainty that's really going to be the factor, like you're saying, that can break them down, because that would be such an energy suck.
But the physical training, you've also got to be physically in the best shape of your life. North of 60,000 feet of climb and the same in descent. It's not a joke. They're red line climbs that never end. As soon as you get off one, you're right on the next one. And you also have to run your equipment right at the red line all the time. You can't go up a lot of those hills without going beyond. You have to figure out how long can you stay over the red line before the motor really blows up.
In the documentary, which we'll put in the show links, there's several images of some of the competitors coming back after a loop with the bottom parts of their legs below the knees absolutely cut to shreds. What is the cause of that, Slaz?
That's just the little briars and stuff. Those are, everyone always really is fixated on those. But now I never let my legs get that way. I wore something over them because I'm a sissy. And
yeah.
Some of them in order to just stay cooler on the climbs, because you get so hot when you're exerting that kind of effort. They'll expose a little of their flesh, but really they're just scratches. And they don't hurt until the third or fourth time that a thorn scratches right through the exact same spot.
Yeah, so it looks worse than it is. And I guess if you've got these little scratches that have got a little bit of blood, but then you're sweating, it the blood runs all over your legs, and eventually you just look like you've been sprayed with red paint.
Yeah, it's some people, they plow right through the briars and get all cut up. It helps you in the race if you're good in the woods and you can see the animal trails and follow the trails instead of just cut a straight line through everything.
Yeah. Okay. I'm interested in that. Just I wrote a little point down there. We used to do some adventure races, and we got timed out on one race. You know, we missed the cutoff after about 30 hours because we were too slow in the various disciplines which we had to do. We had hiking, we had mountain biking, we had kayaking, I think, and then we had some rope work to do. What was our downfall was those 5 minutes that you talked about, Laz, where there was four of us and we were looking at the map and we came to a junction and we weren't entirely sure where to go. So it's like 5 minutes spent discussing left or right. Occasionally you make a wrong turn and you have to come back to where you were discussing it. But when you add up all of those 5 minutes, all of a sudden you've lost an hour. And that's exactly what you're talking about the problem solving.
You have to understand when you get off course, which will probably happen to even people that have done it many times on their fifth loop, but to stop, get your bearings, figure out the best solution, and then go. But there's a human tendency to, you panic. And you try to solve a problem of having a navigation problem with additional speed. Additional speed is the worst solution for a navigation issue.
Yeah.
Because it just means you can get more lost faster.
Well, and also fatigue, you know, and mental acuity plays a big part in that. Once you've been going for 4 days, so you're physically tired, you're mentally tired, you've not had any sleep, so it's easy to make a wrong decision. And then you get that confirmation bias thing where you look at the map, you see some woods, you start to think, well, those woods must be this part on the map, so you start making the decisions based on what you think it is rather than what it really is, and that's when it goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, I think experience of dealing with those kind of things, you kind of find a way. You've got to take a deep breath and pull your scattered brain together and, you know, say, you just have to focus for a moment. And then I'll go back into La La Land. But just for a moment, I've got to focus on this.
Okay, Laz, let's talk about some of the little traditions that we've had. So the entry requirements. In the documentary, people are required to bring you a license plate from their homeland. And one year it was a white shirt. I think you were lacking white shirts. So what? There's one of the white. You're still working your way through them then.
Somewhere I've got a box because the white shirts have a long life expectancy on me. They go through different phases of life. And then there's socks and other items that are useful. One year it was 12 packs of soda so that anything that prevents me from having to make a trip to the store.
Fabulous. Okay.
The license plates were one of those things. It seemed like a good idea at the time. We'd been doing the race for some years before we did the license plates. And we did that one year and hung them up and thought, well, we could just start keeping these and show all the places people come from. It'll be so cool. Now there's 400 of them. And I've got to store the damn things, and I'm going to have to go a day early next time we have the race so I can just get all the damn things hung up.
it
seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah, now it's become a drain on your time rather than something fun. So what about the cigarette, lighting the cigarette to start then? The idea that they wouldn't know when the race was going to start, but they have to wait until you stand by the gate and light the cigarette.
Oh, no, they know. We blow a conch shell exactly an hour before the start. And that's when you know when it starts. And it's over a 12-hour period. So from midnight one night till noon the next day, it seems to, for whatever reason, not help me get a good night's sleep the night before the race. And then the cigarette was just because, aren't all of the great races traditionally started by lighting a cigarette?
I'm not sure. Certainly not the Ironman. Certainly not the Ironman triathlon. You don't find many smokers doing Ironman. But in a sport like running, where you find most people don't smoke, it seems like quite contrary to sort of start the race with a cigarette.
Never felt like you should do something just because that's what people expect you to do.
Absolutely. So the book pages then, right? Now I love this bit. The books as the checkpoint. So can you explain to people how that all works then?
There are a very, depending on how the course is laid out, there's a number of books and they are not hidden but put out of sight to where you have to know where they are. And you just go from one book to the next. You have your bib number like all races. When you get to the book, you take your bib number out of the book, that page.
Okay.
And then when you get in, you turn in all of your pages, and if they're all there, your lap counts. The first 2 years we had it, we didn't have the books, but it came to my attention that this could surprise you. There's a lot of people who can't really read a topo map and have no idea where they are in the woods, and they come in saying, "Oh yeah, I did it. I did it." But you knew they didn't do it. And so we talked among ourselves, and Ed Furtas, that was the one, suggested, what about paperback books? Because we thought of different things you could use. Well, paperback books would work because they're all pages. And then we could make you pull your bib number so you can't go to the book and pull the subsequent pages in advance because you don't know what page you're going to need. And it's also handy because the way they're placed, there's a certain number of them we can get to quickly. And we always have in camp access to some really good people at traveling the short distance through the woods. So if someone's been gone for a couple of days, we can send a runner out to check the middle book and see, did he get there? And then whichever side he's on, you go to, then you can cut them down really quick to exactly where they got lost. Whether they're still within 50 miles or not, we don't know.
So If I'm going to tear a page out of a book and you and mine, so you've got 40 people, but if I'm number one, right, and he's number two, that's one and two are on the same piece of paper. So do the numbers, they're not consecutive there. Every other number, are they, to take into account pulling the pages out?
Yes, we get entirely odd numbers.
Okay.
And now in the era of computers, it's great because we can have the numbers printed in just odd numbers. In the old days, you had to buy 300 numbers and then pull every other one out.
Okay. And then what about, do you change the book for each lap then, or do you just reissue the bib numbers so that they take out the pages further into the book?
The books have to have 250 pages in them. If we get a book that has a perfect title, but it has fewer pages than that, we get another book of the same size. And we cut off the front of that book where that it picks up where the pages of the first book lines up. And then we slit the binder and put them together and rebind them so that you have one book that's actually two books combined, the first 125 pages are one book, and then the rest is a different one.
Got you. Now, I understand that you like to look for books with quirky titles to make people laugh. So can you remember some of the books that you've used and some of the titles?
One of my favorites with the books, also the titles, it's not that they're quirky. Every year there's kind of a theme to the race. So we have a collection of books with Barkley sounding titles, and then we pick them to go with each one, and then you put the books at the specific place on the course. Since I know when it's going to start, And I know when people will be getting to different places and what they've been through and what's to come up. And you fit them to what's going on in their head at that moment. And some of the runners pick that up. They say, hey, he's messing with us.
Can you give us an example?
The first book is always something, Great Expectations. The immense journey. The first book is always positive, and then as the race goes along, the book's titles prey on people's feelings about the race as it changes. And then the last one, the best last book, I think, was it wasn't always easy, but I sure had fun.
it's true. You are a sadist creature then.
And I read somewhere one year that you had some porno books in there, Laz. Was that right?
One of the early years when I still was running it myself, we got entirely, the books didn't really match up to the course so much as they were all porno books. Hardcore, raunchy, nasty truck stop books. Because we like to have fun.
Yeah, well, so Laz, the Barclay Marathons are not the only events that you've done. I've got some of the titles here. I'm not sure if you run all of these now or if they've sort of come and gone. There was the Biggs Backyard Ultra. Now, I thought it was the Big Backyard Ultra, but it's Biggs Backyard Ultra. Was Biggs a character that you knew?
No, Biggs is my dog. He's
he's
right here behind me. I don't know if I can tilt this and you can see him. Oh, can you see him over there?
Yeah,
there he is.
Well, we can see him. For listeners who obviously don't have the benefit of Zoom like we do, Biggs is fast asleep in his little cot behind Laz as we're chatting here, so he's not at all bothered by our conversation.
No, he's past 13 now, so he does lot of sleeping. But this is he's about as far from me as he likes to get. Preferably, he's within arm's reach at all times.
So this is his backyard. So I'll let you explain about the Backyard Ultra because it sounds very similar to something going right back to the 1800s that I'll come to in a minute. So can you just explain how the Backyard Ultra works?
It's a 4.166667 mile course, and you start and you run that. You have an hour to finish it because exactly an hour later you do it again. And exactly an hour later, you do it again. And you keep doing it until only one person can make it. It's literally a battle to the death. And the reason it's named Biggs Backyard is because he's a 100-pound pit bull. And he is, as far as I know, the only pit bull in history who hosts a competition in which humans fight to the death.
That's amazing. So there is actually, I've heard there's another race in Ireland that's very similar called the Last Man Standing. Have you heard of that one?
They're all related. There were when all of this, you know, you may not know it. There's some kind of bug going around, and and it's kind of wreaked havoc on the race schedule. At the time they stopped that, there was 118 backyard ultras in 30-something countries, maybe 40.
Okay.
And they're all connected, and Biggs Backyard is now the world championship. So a certain number of those have golden tickets, and then the other ones is the top winners from all those, and they all come to Biggs Backyard and compete to see who is either the toughest or the dumbest person on earth.
Okay.
So, well, and the Ireland one is also one of those series, and it's a golden ticket event.
So your race was the inspiration for all of these others then?
It It must have been a good idea because it's really caught on. They're a hell of a good time. So they're very social. Everybody's together every hour.
Yeah. And what's the longest anybody's gone on for then?
68 hours.
Let's go back to the 1800s, the late 1800s. Captain Robert Barclay.
He did the 1,000 miles in 1,000 hours, but that's really a very different kind of a thing, because there, the really your obstacle is mostly sleep deprivation.
Mm.
And the backyard is set up where your body wears down and you start to run out of time. As your loop times decline, your rest time also declines.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a whirlpool that you're just getting sucked down into.
Yeah.
The four miles in an hour is just not real hard. And almost everyone can do that with, and certainly the people that are competing at this, they can do it with relative ease. And what it comes down to is how many more times you really do it. I thought initially that people would go as far as they could go, and you know, you would see how long you could endure. But in reality, once you get past the first day, it's a matter of when you no longer believe you can win, it becomes totally a mind game. It's a little bit poker and a little bit running, and because you can't show weakness. You can't let the people racing you see that you hurt, because if they feed off of that. So rather than most ultras where people are telling you all their gruesome stories and how beat and tired and hurt they are, they're all out there saying, "I feel great. I know what you mean. I have never felt better in my life. Yeah, you guys don't even know the half of it. I feel better than any human has ever felt in the history of the world. I could do this forever. I hope it never ends." And inside, of course, they're in agony and think. And then you have the privileges as being race staff. You can go around and hear the private conversations between the crews and the runners. And there's a consistent theme of the runners saying, "I don't have a chance. These guys are invulnerable." And then the crew saying, no, they hurt just like you. You can do this.
I'm just imagining Big wandering around as well, just sort of sitting in a corner with his paw over his head, shaking it while he's listening to all of those mad humans talking about running around his garden.
He sits at the scorer's table and watches the whole thing from beginning to end.
Does he present the prizes as well?
Prizes?
Of course. Yes, yeah,
most
of course.
Races, the prize should be that you get to stop.
So you've had great titles for some other races. The two-bit marathon.
That was my first distance race I put on.
Still going?
That was one of the early ones. No, it was a 25-cent marathon. This is back in the early 70s. And when race fees were getting where they were like $4, $5 to enter a marathon, and it was, you know, just as a protest against that kind of gouging, we had the two-bit marathon. But a lot of the marathoners see little humor in a 29-mile marathon.
Well, you could make them run 29 miles and just round it down to 26 like you do with all those other events.
That's kind of what we did. And, you know, they said, "You're free to stop at 26 if you want to, but yeah, you will be 3 miles from the finish."
They do get a bit serious, don't they, runners? I saw that a couple of years back, somebody took a race organizer to court because they'd set a personal best on a half marathon because their Garmin watch told them so, but actually... It didn't count, you know, and so that they were suing the race organizer for the wrong distance or something.
The Garmin has been the bane of race direction.
Yeah.
And now, anytime you hold an ultra, at the end of the race, you have 20 people standing there with their stupid damn watches that are not near as accurate as everyone likes to say they are.
Yeah.
And they're all telling you that it's not 41.2, it's 43.6, it's 48.1. It never dawns on them that all 20 of them have different distances that they all think are precisely accurate. And they run on tracks and tell you they've gone more miles than they have. And say, no, we've got your lap times, lap by lap by lap, and they're all the same. There is nowhere for there to be a missed lap. Because these watches, you just have to understand the free enterprise economy to understand that when you make a watch to measure distances for runners and you put it through QC, the bottom tolerance has got to be zero. You never want a watch to leave your factory to measure short. Because that always hell. Nobody has trouble if the watch is long. I'd have people walk with me on my Transcon, and whenever I had the chance, I stopped at a mile marker on the road. And I would finish at a mile marker because then I knew exactly how many miles I've been. I mean, that's surveyed to the point where they can build a road from one side of the country to the other and meet in the middle. They know their measures are right. And someone would walk with their watch, and at the end of the day, I'd say, well, that's 31 good miles. And they'd say, no, I've got 32.76. Don't you want to put the exact mileage? But when I walked open range or something, and that was the best I have, I got to admit, I didn't round down the Garmin knowing it was long. I just took that mile and said, okay.
Yeah. So tell me about Nick Marshall then. You've got his 24-hour trail race. Was he a friend of yours?
It was on a track. Nick Marshall is one of the real forefathers of modern ultra running. I don't think near enough people know who he is or who he was. He wrote about the sport when there were magazines and no internet and no nothing. He wrote the annual summary, which would come out on a couple of pieces of paper. And then later on became a small book. He would summarize every race in the country. He wrote stories for magazines. When I first heard of ultras, I was running marathons, and I said, that is just stupid, and I will never do that. But then Nick Marshall wrote an article about running in the Lake Tahoe 72-mile run. I read that article and I said, this sounds great. I have to try this. And I think a lot of the people who started, most people who run today were brought into it or influenced into doing it by someone who is influenced by someone who is influenced by someone who's influenced by Nick Marshall. He's in all of our backgrounds.
So I'm particularly interested in the idiots run that you put on. What was that all about?
It was when the county I lived in was all gravel roads. They paved all the roads now, so they're not fun. So they had the gravel roads, which was hard dirt, and you would have lots of big chunks of gravel just laying on that hard-packed dirt. And there were lots of hills, and we just took the course and we did, we called it 100 miler or something, but it was like 123.6 miles. And it just went from one nasty climb to another as fast as it could, all on those gravel roads with the rocks that hurt your feet. Which now when I think about it, yeah, it's an idiotic thing to do, which is probably what we thought then. So it was a run for idiots.
Did you fill the entry list?
Back then, ultras didn't fill the entry list. You would have, for a really long race, you get 15 or 20 people. For Now, if you had a hundred person ultra back then, would be the biggest race in the country, except for the JFK, which has always had huge fields. But all the other ones were races were 30 people, 50 people. When I first started doing it, lots of your magic number was five. You needed five people for it to be a race. And a lot of the grassroots events, they struggle to make that five every time.
Wow. I'm interested in the Strolling Jim 40. I'd like to know about the name, but also I would like to know about this formula that you used in the Strolling Jim to calculate gender differences, because I think you were a bit of a pioneer in that one.
The Strolling Jim itself was and Strolling Jim was a world championship walking horse, and this is walking horse country where I was putting it on. So we just wanted to pick a name that would appeal to the local people and help get support to put it on. We held it actually this year, just a couple of weeks ago, and we had only 33 runners instead of 600, so that we could space them out and have a start every 3 minutes. And they all waited in their car until it came time for them to go get their bib, put on their bib, give their shirt to their crew, because everyone had to have a crew, and start. So we had a socially distanced ultra. We managed to hold it. Of course, it's 33 people instead of 600, because a start every 3 minutes, unless you want to be out there for 4 days, you can't have that so many people in it. The formula for the women, we changed it over when after I had retired and became serious about just putting on races, and we were trying to build it up, and we thought it'd be fun to have a prize. Because our course record is 359.26, which is on those hills, that is sizzling fast. Andy Jones said it. He's got the fastest 40 miler ever recorded. He's Olympic, just off Olympic class marathoner. And so he said that, you know, we're raising funds for the school, but the school said, try to build interest. We'll take $1,000 out of our money every year and just set it aside. And it's a prize for the person who wins. And every year we add $1,000 to it until it builds up. And it got to the point where now the race has gotten bigger and it can support that. We said, well, we could add a prize for women. But now the women's record, while it's a really good time, it's not in the same stratosphere as the men's record. The men's record is one where literally an Olympic type marathoner is going to have to come and do it. People came and tried for the prizes. It got bigger and bigger, but they're not getting within, you know, 5 or 10 minutes of it. And that's people that are, you know, Olympic trials marathoners. So, well, we should add a prize for women, because I always wanted to do it. I said, but what we need to do, we'll just start with the 1,000, because when this prize was won, it wasn't going to be replaced. We'd start back over with 1,000 if someone ever came in and broke it. So we can't sit here and make, it was up to $6,000. We can't just make a $6,000 prize, because there's probably, you know, 100 women who could just come in and pick it up. They don't even have to break out of their training, just come over here and pick up a quick $6,000 check. And the race is to raise funds for the school, not to write checks for runners. Not that we wouldn't be overjoyed to see some Kenyan. And we had some Kenyans signed up this year that we're going to come and take a shot at. And we would be tickled to see some kind of Kenyan or some really great American Olympic caliber marathoner run an ultra and pick the prize up. So well, the fair thing to do is just start it, like, do the same prize we did with the mint. Start it at 1,000, and we'll pay that 1,000 out on a pretty regular basis until the record gets pushed down a little further. But it's no big deal. But it created a furor. So we said, okay, I'm totally agreeable to paying an equivalent price, 6,000 for women, 6,000 for men. But it has to be to do an equivalent feat. You know, it can't be, and you go and look, and it's like the top 10th of a percent of men could do it, but the top 15% of women can do it. It's not the same feat. So we took all the world records for all the different distances, and then we took the world records for the distance events. We took the world records for all the ultra marathon distances and calculated out and I think it's pretty well known. It's like about 11% difference between the two, but we averaged it all in together to be as fair as we could, figure out what would be a woman's time to be the equivalent of the men's record. And it came out to, just like the men's record, a number that everybody looks at and says, well, I can't do that. So it became a furor. I always have felt like if someone's trying to give me something, I take it in the spirit which it was intended. And our intention was to try to work women in and include them. And if not writing them a big check, right, you know, for just showing up is not satisfactory, then I don't know. I don't know exactly what we'll do. The first thought was, well, screw it. It causes problems. Just get rid of it. We got 600 people. You're signing up and it's growing. We don't really have any need to do this. But then all those Kenyans entered this year. And how many people in ultras wouldn't like to see some of the fast Kenyans? These weren't the top tier of Kenyans because the prize money hadn't built up that high yet. And I don't think they would take it with them, although they have a different motivation than the American runners who, while they might want $6,000, it's not like 3 years' pay at home. If you know what I mean.
Ah, okay. So still to be won then, that prize, I suppose, in future years.
Still to be won. Don't know if we'll leave the prize for the men's record up or not. Don't know what we'll do about the women, but it's a fundraiser for the school. We can't just set up something where that we're going to write out more money than. You know, we always knew that the year that we had to pay that out, well, most of it's covered by the money we've built up, but we don't have another $6,000 built up. Mm. We would have to build that up the same way we did the first one.
Beth, you had a question about Laz's races, like asking which was his favorite children or child.
Yes. Yeah, you have a favorite, Laz. Which one's your baby?
Oh, that's always been my answer when people ask which one's my favorite. It is. It's like, what's your favorite child? Each race is different, and the races I put on are ones that I really enjoy for what they offer for people. I think seeing. Your object is that you're not just selling them a t-shirt and a hat and a Facebook post, but that it's an experience that they enjoy and get something from.
I have one question for you about the Barclay Marathons before we sort of talk about coronavirus and the impact it's had on your races and the you know, the industry as a whole. Kilian Jornet, you must have heard of him. He's the Spanish guy that's broken just about every record in the world for fell running and mountain running. Has he ever shown any interest in coming to do the Barclay Marathons? And if he did, do you think he might be somebody who could finish?
Well, physically, he would certainly. You can't question that he would be able to finish physically. It's a race that demands a lot of different skill sets, and you know, you have to be able to navigate, you have to be able to make your plans and carry all the stuff you need. I don't really know enough about him outside of the times and distances and the other numbers involved to have any idea. Some people actually run up against it just because there's no crowd. The aid stations, you could keep aid stations in Ultra and not give out aid. They would help the runners because it's people there to encourage them. It's a lot different to be out in the woods entirely by yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're coming to the end of our conversation now, but we have touched on this a couple of times. Coronavirus. It's, you mentioned how it had affected the strolling gym. You do have small fields in a lot of your events. Does that mean that do you think you'll be better placed to get rolling again once you're given the all clear than some event organizers?
Well, we've done some things that help us be a little better off as far as picking it back up. All the races are independent entities, and financially they're reported as independent entities. I do accrual accounting, if that makes any sense to you. So when the race collects, you know, it's different than most business in that you collect your money, and then over a period of time you spend it preparing for the race. Then you have the whole race and the wrap-up expenses, and at the very end you figure out what you made. So it looks like, from hearing people talk, what most of the race businesses have done, it's much simpler when they get money in for a race. They recognize it as revenue. They pay in the amount of money on the quarterly taxes. They do point in time account. And as long as a race follows a race follows a race follows a race, well, your expenses from the last race are counterbalanced over the income from the next. And as long as you never stop, that kind of works. But when everybody got caught stopping between collecting the revenue and holding the race, they've already paid out their taxes on the revenue. And then there's not expenses to come along, and you feel like you want to give the runners a refund, but money's not there. So we still have the runners' money from our races. So these races, except for the amount that was actually spent on the race, we could refund what's left. Most of them are rolling it over and doing different things. So we can just start over when the time comes, because all the money for each race is still there with that race. And we've just frozen the money until, as each race approaches, we decide the strolling gym, we gave them a rollover or a refund for all but 33 runs. And then we're coming up on the Heart of the South race, and we're trying to figure out a way, since it's an open road race, really the hardest thing to figure is the bus ride to the start. Because once they leave the start, there's not going to be anybody anywhere near them. They're outside on the road.
That's definitely what you're talking about there in terms of finances and refunds is definitely what's happened in the triathlon world. They're not able to offer full refunds, and that's definitely provoked the angst of a lot of the runners or a lot of the triathletes who don't understand why they can't have a full refund. But you've explained it very articulately there, is that money's already been factored in for other expenses and already laid out, so they can't get that back from the people that they've paid it to, and so that makes it more difficult. So what I guess a lot of people might have thought you had quite antiquated thinking there seems to have worked in your advantage.
I've been criticized for it. My tax person thinks, you know, was highly critical of it until this year.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, now it really stands in good stead. I would throw this in for all the race directors. People really don't get it about the race directing business now because the expectations are so high. But the work on next year's race starts the day after this race is over. And the expenditures follow the same thing. You work along to it. The vision the runners or triathletes, I'm sure, have a lot of times about the race directors is you come down there on race day and you start the race, and when the race is over, you're done. And in reality, the race day is intense, and it's under pressure with time constraints. But out of the work that goes into putting on a race, it isn't shit.
Yeah. Well, I work as a race announcer for a series of races in the UK, and Beth and I both volunteer in races at Ironman events around the world, and so we know a lot more than most athletes about what goes in. Beth, you had a question for Laz.
Yeah, Laz. So we want to talk about one race that you have going on right now, and you can let us know if people can still join. It's the Great Race Across Tennessee. So is that something that people can still join in now?
You can still sign up. This is the 15th day. So if you sign up today, you're out 14 days. You still have 100 and... come on, do the math in your head.
14 times 5.
109 days. I was doing it right.
Oh, okay.
My problem with math is I'm trying to do it two different ways at the same time. It's 100, you still have 109 days left to cover 1,000 kilometers. It's from the extreme southwest part end of Tennessee to the extreme northeast tip. And there's a course map and really a pretty pleasant Facebook group because we moderate the hell out of it. And you follow along and see where you are. You can use the Google Earth and see the places you are on the course. And we expected 200, we got 19,000. If you enter now, you miss some of the bugs that happened over the first 4 or 5 days because the system that was tried and true and worked year in and year out with no problem for 200 runners was quite overwhelmed with when it, by the time it hit about 8,000 or 9,000.
Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes, Laz, although the show may definitely won't come out next week. We've got one scheduled, so there'll be another 20 days gone before this comes out. But what we'll do is, actually, I've got a couple of Facebook pages that I run for my triathletes, so we'll do an advance notice of it on there anyway to see if anybody. We've definitely got one person in our group that's signed up for you, but we'll put a little bit about there. It doesn't sound like you need any more participants. But
well, we're raising, of course, it's also saving me from a year with zero races, but we're raising money for the food bank here in Tennessee, and it looks like that we're going to be able to really give a whopping donation to the food bank. I'm pretty pleased with that.
You're a good fella, Laz. You really are. Do you have a question there, Beth?
No.
Listen, I'm looking at the clock here. It looks like it's gone past 11 a.m. your time, Laz, which means that if you were sticking to that start time for your walk today, well, I'm afraid we've delayed you by 8 minutes. So I'm terribly sorry about that.
I've been missing by a lot. The last 3 weeks has been a lot of, oh, God, it's 11 o'clock already. Oh, God, I can't believe what time it is. There was, there's been a lot of 20 and 21 hour days. It's because unlike the one guy I saw whose comment was, it's a virtual race, huh? And it's automated. So all you do is start it and push a button.
If only it was that simple, eh? Well, listen.
Yeah, I wish I would have paid him to help because I need to know how to do that.
Listen, Laz, it's been absolutely fabulous. I'm so glad that we persisted and got you back on the show. It's been entertaining and educational. I'm fascinated by your races. I love the way you choose the different names for them that make people curious. And I love the quirky little things you do with the Barclay Marathons. It's great. And I don't think that you are, what did they call you, a sadist creature at all. No, I think that people love it. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep chasing you for those events. So thanks for everything you do on behalf of all the people that have entered your races and will do. And good luck getting everything going again once we're allowed to have a bit more freedom about how we operate.
Well, I appreciate y'all having me back. I felt really bad that it didn't work out last time because it was held up because I'm an idiot who can only work a phone and a wristwatch and not the ones with all the bells and whistles.
You know, you're ahead of all of us, though, because I have a feeling there's going to be numerous people spending numerous hours searching where and when to send their Barclay essay now. Oh, you could teach us all a lesson.
There'll still be plenty of Barclay essays show up.
Well, Laz, thank you so much again. Best wishes staying safe and healthy out there in the woods. It sounds like you're in the best place at the moment. And best wishes for your races. And thanks once again for being a guest.
All right, y'all have fun in your various places. And now I'm going to put on my shorts and slip out from between you so I'm no longer trapped and surrounded.
Okay,
Laz. Thank you so much, Laz.
Take care. Bye now.
Bye.
Bye.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.